You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Do we have small talk?
No, I don't think we have small talk.
Okay.
So this is Leaping Cholla podcast. We're reading contributions to philosophy of the event. And we're going to dive straight in. Because small talk is for small minds. And we're on section 46.
Yes.
Right?
Page 79.
79?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and start reading.
46. The decision, preliminary concept. About what? About history or loss of history, i.e. about belonging to being or abandonment in non-beings. Why decision, i.e. because of what, can that be decided? What is decision anyway? Choice? No. Choosing always concerns only something pre-given, something that can be taken or rejected. Here, decision means grounding and creating, disposing in advance and beyond oneself, or else abandoning and losing. Yet is that not here and everywhere both arrogant and impossible at the same time? Is it not in concealment that history comes and goes as it does? Yes and no. The decision arises in the stillest stillness and has the longest history. Thoughts? Do you want to? Or should I?
This is the, I think the third section that is essentially titled The Decision, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're continuing this investigation into decision. In the past, he has tried to make clear that he's trying to establish a definition of decision that is different than something like preference or
choice.
Or choosing. So this continues that, and the decision about what? And he says here that it's a decision about history or loss of history, i.e. about belonging to being or abandonment in non-beings. So the decision he's talking about is essentially about an either or. It's deciding, it's a decision that kind of, I guess I would say, lies in between or attempts to navigate the differences between history and loss of history, or belonging to being, or abandonment in non-being. So those are alternatives to each other. We want our decision to be about history or the loss of history. So, for instance, what is history? What is the loss of history? How do we identify those two things, what they mean? How do we make a decision between them? Or how do we make our decisions about that, meaning the decision gives us history or the decision takes history away? This decision increases our belonging to being, or it increases our abandonment in non-beings. Yeah, why decision? Because of what? Why are we deciding? And can we decide why we're deciding? Good question. What is decision? Choice? No. Choosing always concerns only something pre-given, something that can be taken or rejected. So the decision he's talking about is not, does not concern something pre-given. It just, it probably, I guess it concerns something ungiven or to be given. And it's not something that can be taken or rejected. Decision means grounding and creating, disposing in advance and beyond oneself, or else abandoning and losing. That's the option. It is that not here and everywhere, both arrogant and impossible at the same time. Is it not in concealment that history comes and goes as it does? Yes and no. So what does he mean by this? Is it not in concealment that history comes and goes? And why does that follow this? Decision means grounding and creating, disposing in advance and beyond oneself. Is it not in concealment that history comes and goes as it does? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about this?
No.
So he's setting up the idea that decision means grounding and creating. Mm-hmm. So instead of choosing or preferencing, decision means grounding something. So grounding it in the truth of Bang, or grounding it as a truth, and creating, bringing something new into the world, disposing in advance. So putting something forward and putting it beyond oneself. And if you're not doing that, then abandoning and losing, which is, you know, always an option. Yet is that not here and everywhere to do what he just said, both arrogant and impossible at the same time? So is it arrogant and impossible to ground and create, to dispose in advance and beyond oneself? Is it not in concealment that history comes and goes as it does? So I guess he's saying that this grounding and creating, this disposing in advance and beyond oneself, would be a kind of evident or visible history making. Mm. And he's saying, doesn't history only occur in concealment? Mm. I mean, in a certain way, that sort of smells to me of Freudianism. Doesn't the true history of a thing, doesn't its true story, doesn't its true lineage lie unconsciously buried beneath the shallow and irrelevant minutiae of the visible and apparent world? And Heidegger says yes and no. Because the decision arises in the stillest stillness and has the longest history. Mm. Kind of mystical there, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think to conclude, if the decision arises in the stillest stillness and has the longest history, then decision comes forward as a kind of generative, timeful phenomenon, a kind of bedrock or primordial soup of existence that churns beneath us and within us. It's the constant attempts at grounding and creating and moving beyond ourselves. So I don't know. I mean, do you have anything to say about what he's trying to say decision is? I mean, it feels a little bit to me like decision could be thought of as the imminent and ever recurring appropriation by Bang. And making oneself available for that appropriation, which one has been doing continually as Dasein, but it often happens in concealment or in secret or in stillness and in long and cryptic histories. Mm-hmm. Because it's really our, how should we say, our connection to nature, mm. our manifold and widespread contextual connection mm-hmm. to everything around us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't know if I brought any light to that, but yeah. Right. Okay, go ahead.
Who decides? Everyone, even by not deciding and by not wanting to know about it through an avoidance of the preparation. What is to be decided? We ourselves, who are we in our belonging and non-belonging to being? The decision is related to the truth of being, not only related to it, but rather determined by it alone. What is intended here is thus decision in a preeminent sense, and that is the reason for speaking about the most extreme decision, which is at once the most intimate.
Yeah, he's saying a little bit here. What I kind of said is that everyone is always deciding, even when they're not deciding and not wanting to know things, they're making decisions. That seems obvious. Mm-hmm. What is to be decided? We ourselves, who are we? In our belonging and non-belonging to being. So decisions about what we are, who we are, how we belong, and how we do not belong to being. It's a little what I said in terms of decision being the long history of our appropriation by Bang and our positionality vis-a-vis natural contexts in which we live. The decision is related to the truth of being. Same thing as I said, not only related to it, but rather determined by it alone. So the decision is determined by the truth of being. So we place ourselves mm-hmm. in relation to being, in relation to the truth of being, and we gather our decisions from that truth. So decision here is intended in a preeminent sense. So decision is preeminent, meaning it is a kind of its role is as an establisher of us, and that is the reason for speaking about the most extreme decision, which is at once the most intimate, meaning the most extreme decision almost is the farthest away, the longest, the deepest, which is in a sense. Because it's a record of our contextual relationship with nature is most intimate to us, to our Dasein. All right, go ahead.
But this decision is because of what? Because only out of the deepest ground of being itself is there a saving of beings. Saving as justifying preservation of the law and assignment of the West. Must that be? How does it happen that there is a saving only in this way? Because the danger has increased to the extreme on account of the uprooting taking place everywhere, and also, which is even more portentous, because this uprooting is already in the act of hiding itself. In other words, because the onset of the lack of history is already here.
Yeah, so he's doing a little bit of cultural valuation here. But this decision is because of what? Why is this decision? Because only out of the deepest ground of Bang itself is there a saving of beings. So beings are saved, meaning they are perpetuated, they are traditionalized, they are made consistent, they last over time. Beings do. And it's only out of the deepest ground of Bang itself that this occurs. So if you wish to have beings saved, then you need to get in touch with the deepest ground of Bang. Saving as justifying preservation of the law and assignment of the West. All right. So, the West, by which Heidegger probably means German philosophy, but, he means more than that, but you know, it's interesting that he just kind of drops that there. You know, I think he means the philosophical perspective of the West, which he traces all the way back to Greece and, of course, then emanates through Europe, etc. So the saving of beings is, in a sense, the justifying preservation. So to preserve and justify the law and assignment of the West, the great metaphysical tradition of the West. Must that be? Must that be, I guess, but this is because only out of the deepest ground is there a saving of beings. Must that be? Is that how it must work? How does it happen that there is a saving only in this way? Why is it that saving and justifying and preserving the law and assignment of the West only emerges out of the deepest ground of Bang? Why is that? Because the danger has increased to the extreme on account of the uprooting taking place. How does it happen that there is a saving only in this way? And he says, essentially because the law and assignment of the West is being uprooted. The uprooting is already hiding itself. So the West, the law and assignment of the West is essentially fading away. It's hard to tell whether he thinks that's a good or bad thing, but mm-hmm. that's what he says is happening. Yeah. Which, you know, I think everything is always fading away. That's probably, I'm not really quite sure what he's getting at there, but yeah. Let's keep reading.
The decision arises in stillness, not as coming to a resolution, but as the resoluteness that already grounds truth, i.e. recreates beings, and thus is a creative decision, or else in stupor.
Or else is stupor, yeah.
Or else is stupor.
Yeah. So to get to the decision, we must be still. That's a pretty Buddhist thing to say. But it's cool. Decision arises in stillness, not as coming to a resolution. Decision isn't coming to a resolution, but it's the resoluteness that already grounds truth. So he's picking hairs here. He's getting nitty gritty on what decision is, and I think it's nice to absorb his observations and try to appreciate the distinctions he's making. Mm-hmm. And so the one distinction here is the difference between coming to a resolution versus being in a state of resoluteness that already grounds truth. What's that difference? Feel that difference. What is that difference? The decision arises in stillness. The decision recreates beings, and thus is a creative decision, or else is stupor. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yet why and how preparation of this decision?
Yeah, why and how do we prepare this decision?
The battle against destruction and uprooting is only the first step in the preparation, namely the step into the nearness of the proper space of the decision.
Yeah, so now he rounds out this whole section with this kind of interesting concern that the law and assignment of the West is being destroyed. And if I had to kind of put my foot down somewhere on this, what he's concerned about, I would say as much beef as Heidegger has with the first beginning and the metaphysics of Greece and the way the metaphysical tradition began, I think he believes that the ingenuity and the precision and the depth and the philosophical rigor that it all started with has slowly degraded, and we have been abandoned by being. That the Greeks started an adventure of investigating being, and as time has gone by, we have let that slip, and we have fallen into machination and historiology and in a sense liberalism and identitarianism, and that has degraded and is destroying the law and assignment of the West that began in Greece. But even more than just Greece, I would say that the law and assignment of the West lies in Dasein, lies in the grounding of the truth of Bang. It lies in the preeminent stillness of a concealed history and a rootedness in discovery and creativity and invention and freedom and philosophy and creating and grounding and disposing things in advance. In other words, establishing not, as he says, existing in stupor and not letting oneself not losing, as he says, but participating in this project of accessing the deepest ground of Bang itself, the event, the time-space field, and living with it and letting it appropriate us and letting the resoluteness of living in Bang be our decision.
I'm confused.
Yeah?
So if it says only out of the deepest ground of Bang itself, so that seems to be a goal, right? In general, yes. I think we generally want to yes. be deeply grounded in Bang.
Definitely.
And I think that sort of is the decision or mm-hmm. is related to the decision. But then he's saying that also in that is the saving of beings.
Yeah.
And the and justifying.
Yeah. That's good. That's a confusing part.
The West. Well, because then it's, I guess I'm confused about, because at the end, the battle against destruction and uprooting is only the first step in the preparation, namely the step into the near. Again, I'm just confused because I feel like in general, is he for or against the battle against construction, destruction and uprooting?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of his primary concerns is abandonment by being. Thought philosophy, truth seeking has become machinated. Mm-hmm. And so we have abstracted and metaphysicalized events, entities, and existences into neutered conceptual forms that we bandy about, and they don't actually have any being. We think they have being, but they have no being. Mm-hmm. So, and that's because we have lost touch with Bang. So the relationship between Bang and being, or Bang and beings, is kind of like the relationship between existence and essence, or the relationship between earth and world, mm-hmm. or the existence between reality, the relationship between reality and identity. Mm-hmm. So the preservation of the ongoing parade of the abandonment by being is not the preservation of beings. It's not mm-hmm. the saving of beings. It's actually just the chatter of people who have been abandoned by being chattering about beings. Mm-hmm. So how do we really preserve beings? How do we save beings? How do we mm-hmm. Keep the law and assignment of the West going? Mm-hmm. How do we stop this uprooting, which is the abandonment by being? We get in touch with the deepest ground of Bang itself, because out of Bang itself emerges being. Only mm-hmm. actual being, true being, only emerges out of bang. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you're right. It's confusing. But he's establishing here a relationship, and he's talking about what this uprooting is. And that's why he says the battle against destruction and uprooting. So the battle against the incessant abandonment by being is the first step in the preparation, namely stepping into the nearness of the proper space of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the proper space of the decision is bang. It's the deepest ground of bang. And it's Dasein and its truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inceptive creativity.
Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit of vibe of like, I don't know what, maybe the metaphor is spinning your tires or talking about nothing. Or throwing around concepts that have no real being, and making decisions between things that neither of which really matter, or things which are really, in a sense, there's no difference between them. It's just chatter and choice, and not being grounded in the truth of bang, not being present in one's concealed history. Not belonging to bang, not being in the stillest stillness, not being present in decision as preeminence. So, I mean, I think I can think of several metaphors. I mean, I think like, say, in the context of anxiety, so much of the response to anxiety is presented as making the right choices vis-a-vis your anxious ideations, right?
Yeah.
And so much of the treatment and the discourse and the books lay heavy on the idea that you've got some choices to make in terms of your intrusive thoughts, in terms of your fears, in terms of your imaginations, you know, in terms of how you handle yourself when anxiety is really strong, and how you handle yourself when it's actually kind of abated. You know, there's just a lot of choices. Mm-hmm. And in a way, all the books are like, just make the right choices. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just make the right choices.
Yeah.
And of course, the books become a little maddening and start to feel a little futile when you realize that you're not really available to make those choices. Mm-hmm. Those aren't actually choices you can make. And then so you're left saying, well, okay, I need to muster the strength to be the kind of person that can make those choices. But if you were the kind of person who could make those choices, you wouldn't have the problem and you wouldn't be reading the book.
Yeah.
So it's a real catch 22, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think what Heidegger, and again, I don't know if he was, you know, necessarily intending this, but I think what we can gather from it and vis-a-vis anxiety is, you know, we can look to phrases like the decision arises in stillness, not as coming to a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision, so much of the decision about anxiety that the books preach definitely doesn't arise in stillness. It arises in like getting active and making the right decision and getting up and going and being, you know, being smart about your choices. And it comes to being resolved and making a resolution. I'm coming to a resolution about my fears, you know. Instead, think the resoluteness that already grounds truth recreates beings and thus is a creative decision. And if it's not, it's stupor. So what is the resoluteness that already grounds truth? And I mean, I think people spend so much time kind of going to the gym of decision.
Mm-hmm.
How can I get stronger so I can make better and more decisions? And when instead of going to the gym of decision muscle building, let's go to the resoluteness that already grounds truth. Now, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
What is that? And it's a good question what that is. So let me bring in another metaphor, you know, and it's, for me, it's always, well, it's often this, you know, it's like sort of the non-yoga yoga that everybody does
mm-hmm.
now. My beef about the non-yoga yoga, that is yoga now, is that there's no breath in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you often go to yoga classes and you're going to do, let's do some pranayama. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Pranayama, is that?
I think so.
Pranayama breathing, I think.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you hold your nostril and you go.
Yeah, you go in one side and you go out the other side.
You do that.
Alternate nostril breathing.
Yeah, I think it's probably not pranayama, but it's something like that.
No, it is. It's something like
and
that.
And you know, they do that, and it's a gimmicky, and everybody's just like, wow.
I breathed.
And then you go and you do like an hour of yoga, and there's no breathing.
Yeah.
The poses are not aligned with breathing. There's no attempt to get everybody's breath going slower than it does when they're like running to work. There's no pacing. There's no instructed breathing. There's no breath. And yoga is breath. Like, the premise of yoga is that if you slow your breath, slow is the first part, if you are intentional about your breath, if you coordinate your breathing with the movements of the asanas, and if you engage in what is going on between breaths, between in-breath and out-breath, and between out-breath and in-breath, this is how you change your mind. Literally, this is how you access your mind. Like, yoga is the art of accessing your mind through breath. That's actually what it is. And none of the non-yoga yoga that everyone practices now has anything to do with that. And I would say the yoga they're doing is actually detrimental. I mean, it's like yoga, you know, the central goal of yoga as stated in the Yoga Sutras is to silence the chattering monkeys of the mind. And yet every yoga class now is taught by chattering monkeys. And it does the opposite of silencing the chattering monkeys of the mind. It fills your mind with chattering monkeys. So it just seems to me to be working in opposition to what should be its primary goal.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to this resoluteness that grounds truth, practice breathing to access your mind is getting into that resoluteness.
Mm-hmm.
Doing yoga that has nothing to do with breath is just coming to resolutions and making choices and preferential choices
mm-hmm.
that get you nowhere. So there are things that, how shall we say, help you access your constitutional structure,
mm-hmm.
and there are things that are just spinning your tires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we can continue to think of examples of this kind of thing. I would say there's, you know, I mean, I think one reason that people, you know, or that there's a little value in this tidbit of advice, which is meditate, you know, what I think people really want to mean when they say meditate, they mean let's cultivate that resoluteness that grounds truth,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just always coming to resolutions
mm-hmm.
again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference there is meditation mm-hmm. versus, I don't know, consumer choice. I don't know, something
yeah,
like that,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
or shopping, or
yeah,
just
choice.
Or just making more resolutions or making more choices as if you're somehow getting somewhere, because really by just making those kind of empty choices, you're just getting to a place where you have to make more choices and you just become a super choice machine.
It's like New Year's resolutions.
Yeah, and so it's like hourly resolutions. You
yeah.
know? So, that's my computer. So he's, you know, he he's trying to talk about that. And I think it has some lessons for anxiety. Like maybe this whole choice game that anxiety therapy is about is really like a misguided waste of time. I don't know. But then, you know, to counter it, you say, well, so how do I get to that resoluteness that in the truth of, in the grounds the truth of being? What is it? How do I get there? How do I get to that place where it's not about choice, it's about being in, you know, the history of my decision, the stillest stillness and the you know, the ancient decision that I'm a part of, you know. How do I get there? Well, you know, I don't know, man. Read this book, think about it, meditate, breathe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're so used to thinking that choice is a recognizable psychological phenomenon and that non-choice...
And is like essential to well-being, yeah, that's right. Choose this or that.
That's right. And not choosing or... participate in the kind of decision that Heidegger is talking about, which seems really kind of vague and hard to get at, is in a sense just not making a choice, and it's just sitting there and staring into space. But actually, I think for me, sensationally, I can feel what it's like to make decisions, and I can feel what it's like to sit in that resoluteness that grounds truth, in that most intimate decision, in that positionality of the Dasein vis-a-vis the truth of being. I can feel what that is, and that's different than just making choices. It's like being present in the way that the truth of being is determining your decisions for you. That's what it is. And he even says something in that regard in this, you know, it's like the truth of being establishes your decisions for you. And it's not that you're being decided for, because that's talking about decision as choice. It's actually that decision is a state of being that you're in all the time.
Yeah. I was just gonna say that it also is just as you're talking, it makes me think it's like a false choice in a way. Like there's sort of like this: do you want this or this?
Yes.
Is not just a false choice, but empty, because it kind of, in a way, either it doesn't matter what it is, or you're not really deciding because you've already decided, or...
Yeah.
Like, and that is a lot of what anxiety is, just being like, oh my God, what if I make a bad decision?
Right. That's right. And your choice grounds nothing, so it changes nothing. So you don't actually ever change.
Yeah.
And the core of you goes through no kind of reformation whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, he says here, choosing always concerns only something pre-given. So so essentially you're choosing like to this or that, but those are just pre-given things that don't really emerge from you. It can be taken or rejected, but in a sense, if you know, we think that when we make a choice we're changing ourselves, but in a sense we're not.
Yeah.
We're actually avoiding changing ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think this, for me, this ties into identity, because I think identity is the trap we get into when we believe that choices change us.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I think we perceive this idea of a kind of personhood that subsists over time. And as we choose, we go from identity.
And that it sorry.
Go ahead. What? Yeah, what?
I would just say that it could change us, that we can make a choice that would change.
Us. And we go from identity subscript A to identity subscript B. And that becomes the focus, is managing our identity through choices, changing our identity, but like maintaining our identity, but saving it. And choice becomes the kind of chisel that sculpts us ever more finely. But we're not actually changing. We're just carrying identity forward through time. And you know, the more you choose, the more you have to choose. And the less, and choices are like, they're like, you know, they get less and less important. It's like inflation. They get less and less valuable. The more you make of them, like the more choices you mint, the less valuable any choices are. It's just like money.
Or so NFTs. Then,
and what's that?
NFTs, you mint.
Yeah,
NFTs.
And then so, you know, you're just like, every your choices get less and less actually relevant and important and I don't know how to say impactful. But then it's a game because you think you're changing yourself. You're like making the right choices.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah.
But it's I think it's an interesting proposition that addressing anxiety has nothing to do with choice.
Yeah, I agree. That's very interesting. Yeah, it makes me think of we were at this event a couple of days ago, and
tell me about the art
it was
show.
An art, yeah, it wasn't a show. It was art visit at a collector's house.
Yeah,
and like the most. Basically, we were like, yeah, we were just talking to people, a few different people we talked to, and it was like, where are you from, blah, blah, blah. We're like, we lived in New York City, we moved to the side of a mountain, super, super rural, and the question that they kept asking, I was surprised, because like everyone asked it, they were like, oh, basically, do you like it? Is that what they said? Or like, are you okay? And it's such a weird question. Like, I think the
context there is that this was a very academic crowd. Mm-hmm. This is a lot of people who work at the university here. And I mean, we live out in the country, but we live near a town of a million people with a university. And I think the subtext of that was like, you know, New York is such a big city,
yeah,
and it's so cultured and vibrant and elite, and you've moved to a kind of, you know, little bit of more of a podunk situation.
Mm-hmm.
And are you okay? Are you like freaking out because it's so damn backwards here?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think the reason that was a jarring question to us is we feel the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have to say, it's a question
that I realize.
There's
nowhere more podunk than New York City. No, in 2025, that's absolutely true.
Yeah,
New York is the most backward podunk shithole on the planet.
Yeah.
In my view.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, first of all, I guess I brought that up because it feels like there's a questioning of the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, in a way, it doesn't feel like a choice that we made to move here.
Mm. You don't think we made a choice to move here?
I mean, I guess we did, but
I don't know.
When they imply it was a choice to move here, like well, first of all, I feel a little uncomfortable because I still have a little of that stuff in me, and I'm like, oh, are we okay? Because I mean, like everyone's asking, are we okay? But that's like the anxiety.
Do you choose to leave a place that's killing you?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Then on the other side, I'm just like, it's just not a relevant question because it wasn't a choice. It was something that had to happen.
It was something.
I mean, we said last time as Muzayin, it's just like we.
We needed to breathe.
Drove up the driveway and it was the place. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we both knew it was the place. It was weird.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was a choice. But it being treated as a choice by other people or questioned as a choice,
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I think that as we look at the arc of our escape from that place, which took years of kind of slow, like, again,
talking ourselves up.
It was never a choice. It was actually just slowly.
Yeah, I realized
the water was rising.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would get up off our knees, and then we get on our tippy toes, and then we'd stick our noses in the air, but the water kept rising. And it seemed impossible that we would ever leave.
Yeah.
But eventually we were just pulled away.
Yeah.
It was not a choice. We were just pulled away. Or another way to put it is it died within us, and it smelled so bad we had to leave.
Yeah.
You know, like, we both went there for a purpose, and we both died there for a purpose. Yeah. And we floated away, and we fled, or we were pulled away, and we were pulled to this place.
Yeah.
You're right. It was never a choice. It was always just kind of like being pulled along.
Yeah.
But by a grounding and a truth that we wouldn't have let ourselves get pulled along if we didn't feel it was towards some truth.
Yeah, right.
And so then I think that if you go to the question of, are you okay? I think you're dealing with some people. I was there at that party. I met the people. I think you're dealing with people who, I don't know if they're necessarily pulled along people.
Mm.
I think they're choiceful people who make the right choices, the correct choices.
There's something there that, like, I think, because, like, of course, I'm like, well, if you're not making choices, what are you doing?
Living,
but like, you're like the pulled away, it almost sounds like being in a current, but then, like, you also pointed out that, like, we knew it was needed to happen but didn't know where it was going or something.
Yeah, you know what I want to say is sort of, like, do you have more to say about that? Relevant to this in a certain sense is I started reading this section of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that is called Democracy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the very first sentence is, so this is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. This is the most important encyclopedia of philosophy in the world. And this is the democracy entry. And the first sentence is, normative democratic theory deals with the moral foundations of democracy and democratic institutions, as well as the moral duties of democratic representatives and citizens. And it goes on to talk and talk and talk about normative democratic theory. Now, this section in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy is not called normative democratic theory. It's called democracy. But the authors of this massive article are so liberal and so academic and so lost in normatives and choices that this whole entry is about normative democratic theory. Mm-hmm. But there's actually a whole lot of democratic theory that is non-normative.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on to say,
like what? Or, I mean,
well, okay, it's essentially, and they reference it briefly in here. There are two theories of democracy: minimalist and maximalist.
Mm-hmm.
The maximalist is the normative.
Uh-huh.
The minimalist is the non-normative. Okay. So minimalist theory of democracy tries to basically define or determine what is the least you need in a governmental system or a national system for a country to be called democratic or for there to be democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the general answer is that democracy is ruled by the people, carried out by free and fair elections,
mm-hmm.
protected by institutions that implement those choices and maintain the rule of law.
Hmm.
Like, as long as that's present, you have democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Maximalist definitions of democracy are all about, and this goes my conversation with your dad.
Hmm.
Maximalist definitions of democracy are that unless you have rights and liberties and protections and constitutions,
well, and morality.
And the right moral decisions as a result of the democratic process, then you don't have democracy. Now, I'm going to get back to this party we were at in Tucson in a second. But the fascinating thing is, if you continue to read in here, they go on and they literally start to talk about, you know, what's really needed for democracy is that there need to be levels of equality, education, literacy, and engagement that generate the correct decisions. And when the correct decisions, okay, are not being made, they literally use that word, correct.
Wow.
Then democracy is not present. So this goes back to, you're right, with your dad and my conversation where I said, well, democracy is just democracy. So I was basically putting forth a minimalist definition of democracy. He was putting forth a maximalist definition. Now, my critique of his definition of maximalism, of normative theories of democracy, says that you're just actually trying to say democracy is not democracy when it doesn't abide by your principles.
Yeah.
It's so obvious. That's the truth. Go back to this party. I think we were in the presence of a lot of liberals for whom correct choices are the way you run your life and the way things ought to go. And so the move from New York to where we live was a choice that we hoped would be correct. And so they were wondering if we felt that we had made the correct decision, which in fact isn't at all how we go about doing things, but they do.
Yeah,
because they are normative, maximalist, correct people. And maybe that's a stretch, but I don't think it is.
I mean, I think, again, for me, I feel like when it comes to anxiety, it's like, well, I mean, I've said this before, but it's like, oh, the anxiety is like, oh, are they right? Is it a decision? Is it, or something? Like, is it something that could be undone? Was it a good decision? So there's something about, sorry, I can't help this
much. But see, I think that's exactly parallel to my talking to you about what I guess I used to call your biological organismal self. Your organismal biological self, which your instinctual organism, which is 99% of what you are. And I always told you, you think you're making all these choices and decisions, but you're not. Most of your decisions and choices are being made for you.
Well, that's what this is saying.
That's what Heidegger is saying. What the people at the party were saying is they're not really super in touch with that. They think everything is a decision and a choice.
Right.
So you can look at liberalism. You can say liberalism is in a sense become the negation of the biological organismal self.
Yeah.
The instinctual survivalistic organismal self. And the extinction of the negation of that and the reaffirmation or the ideologicization of the choiceful identitarian self. That self becomes what we are, how we operate, what we ought to be doing. And that's why correct is so important.
Yes. And because that's why with anxiety, that's why with moralists, the correct is important. Sorry, did you want to finish?
No, I'm done.
And then for me with anxiety, it's like it's the fear of making the wrong choice.
That's right. Well, that's why the age of liberalism, the age of identity, is the age of anxiety, because this form of thinking, this contemporary zeitgeist mentality, it lies in the idea that we are almost completely choiceful beings, and there's no in touch with the kind of concealed history of our design and our appropriation by Bang and our instinctual organismal biological being. That's all out the window. And now everything's just kind of programmatic academic choicefulness, correct choicefulness. And, you know, you're afraid that's right. You're afraid that's the truth. If you're afraid, I mean, you were raised in that tradition. That's your tradition.
Totally.
And I mean, look, you can look at it in this democracy example. I mean, the anxiety right now over the death of democracy.
Yeah.
Okay. Could bury the country in sweat, blood, and tears. I mean, it's enough to, it's enough to send the whole thing under the ocean. I mean, it's big. It's a gigantic, you can hear the screams and groans, right?
Yeah.
All night long. I mean, please back me up? Yes?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I mean, the anxiety over the death of democracy right now is, it's like massive.
Well, it's however,
this is actually anxiety over the maximalist theory of democracy, over normative democracy. This is an anxiety over the denormalization of anxiety, the denormativization of democracy. Like liberals are facing a minimalist definition of democracy, and they don't like it. They don't like it at all. Because a normative democracy is a democracy that is progressing according to their ideals and their choices, and it's correct. And they don't understand democracy outside of the correct decisions. AKA the liberal decisions.
Well, that's always
to them,
been...
democracy dies when it leaves the living room of liberalism.
Yeah, when it leaves a democratic president, democracy dies. And that's what's always been confusing to me about, or I mean, just not quite
making
sense.
It is very
sense.
Confusing it's that like, one could hold that opinion, yes.
Because, and what,
it's very confusing.
Because we are a democratic country. The president was democratically elected.
Yes, exactly. And of course, they think that the other side are making choices that are not correct. Therefore, they're not democratic.
Right.
That's false logic. That's a false syllogism. It doesn't even work. It's not even true in the crudest sense of the term. So they're obviously struggling. And they're struggling because they have become so ingrained in this idea that choice, correct choice, is what
it's the
gives
only
things,
answer.
Yes, that's right. It gives things their essence. It's what it's the essence of things. It's the essence of democracy. And of course, correct choice is not the essence of democracy. Choice is the essence of democracy, but not correct choice.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But yeah, so, and also it is interesting that choice there.
I would go far to say is I'm not sure people always choose their political party or their president or whatever they vote for in the way that we think they do. It's another thing. I think it's a long conversation, but you know, why one votes the way one does, I think, is not just about making the smartest choice.
Or it's not about making a choice.
It's not about making a choice, exactly. It's not about making a choice at all.
More like...
It's like, do you choose to like ice cream over chocolate?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you choose to like chicken over turkey? Do you choose to like wheat flour over non, you know, I mean, do you choose what you, do you choose what musical you like and what you don't? Do you choose taste? Do you choose your partner? Do you choose the person you love? Do you choose to love the person or does it just hit you?
So it's not actually that you have like a deep sense that you know which choice to make because you're in touch with your truth. It's actually that there is no choice to make.
Well, Heidegger would say the choice to make is to get in touch with your truth, and then let that and let then let that be your choice.
Wait, so he would he or would he not say that there is choice?
Well, there's. I mean, if choice decision can be synonymous with choice, it's just a different kind of choice.
Right.
It's a different level of choice.
Right. Yeah. So if you were to say, like, it's like a fear of choice. I mean, I think one definition of anxiety could be a fear of choice. So then what is the alternate to that? What is the other path?
Well, if there's no choice, then why have a fear of choice? Mm-hmm. That's what I've always said to you. It's like you, right. You know, taking the simple example of like the knife on the table, mm-hmm. I might choose to grab it and hurt myself or someone else. Mm-hmm. And what I've always said to you is you don't have the choice.
Right.
I literally said that to you years before we even read this book. I said, mm-hmm. you think you have the choice to do that, mm-hmm. but you don't have the choice. Mm-hmm. And the reason you think you have the choice is you're obsessed with a definition of yourself or an experience of selfness, mm-hmm. that has invested your identity with the aura of choicefulness, mm-hmm. as if you operate by choice, mm-hmm. by I don't know what the word is, conscious choice or something, mm-hmm. but in fact what you are, who you are, what you do is already chosen for you, yeah. pretty much fully, yeah. and the word I used was you, which is different than what you call you, have already chosen to survive.
Yeah.
And you've chosen it a trillion times already. It's been chosen for you. Mm-hmm. And you're just playing that out. And stop thinking you have the choice, mm-hmm. to do something that you don't have the choice to do. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of how much you're in control of yourself, how much who you are, what you are, where you lie, mm-hmm. where choicefulness lies. You know, what's making choices for you? I guess, mm-hmm, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's,
yeah.
I'm not sure I have more words for it than all of that.
Yeah.
But I think the degree that you're infected with liberalism is the degree that you think there's a lot of choice there.
Yeah, right.
You think there's a lot of choice where there's not a lot of choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, like, definitely I feel a very sort of clear understanding of the, in a way, like the problem, but still not a lot of illumination on the alternative.
Alternative to what?
To not having choice. So what do you do if you don't have choice?
Wait, the alternative to not having choice?
Well, the alternative to to not believing in choice, in a way, to be like, oh, there isn't choice. So then what is there? Or is that not a question? Because it, yeah.
Look, you're somebody who scrolls through your social media feed all day long. Now and then something catches your eye, right? Mm-hmm. As maybe interesting or beautiful or a piece of art or whatever. Did you choose for it to catch your eye? Or did it just catch your eye?
Yeah.
Have you chosen your aesthetic attractions, or are they just occurring in you? Mm-hmm. So when you say, what's the alternative to choice? I would, mm-hmm. say you're living it day in and day out in every way. Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to be with me? Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to love your children? Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to enjoy the meal I made for you tonight? Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to want a podcast? Are you choosing to find the mountain beautiful as we walk up the hill? Are you choosing, mm-hmm. to see this, to look at the sunset? Are you choosing to breathe? Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to want to have sex? Mm-hmm. Are you choosing to solve your anxiety problem? Mm-hmm. I think there's a great infection that's upon us now, is that we see everything through as choice.
Yeah.
When, and I think it's because we're afraid of nature and truth. Mm-hmm. We're afraid of death. We're afraid of just realizing that we are being dragged along by natural forces that will inevitably eat us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this grand delusion of all these choices that we can make, and we should make the correct ones. And of course, anytime you do end up making the correct decision, you just look shallow and empty and silly and liberal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because now you're making a correct decision, but then you go home and you cry and you scream and you hate everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There's a real dark underbelly to being correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super true.
And that's because in being correct and making choices continually, you're actually just killing yourself.
Yeah.
You're actually just avoiding yourself. You're actually just negating everything that you are. And you're shutting down and you're turning off all the decisions that actually are what you are, the decisions in the Heideggerian sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you're becoming this big choice machine, which is in fact a big avoidance machine, which is actually a big suicide machine to kill the organism that you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure there's any other way I can describe it.
Yeah, that's well said.
I don't feel like I've really got my thumb on it, but there's something there.
Yeah, totally. That's true. Yeah.
So you have to get that all out of your head. You just have to get it out of your head.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all this choice shit, all this choice, this ideology of choice, mm-hmm. all this idea of the correct choice, of making the correct choice. You just got to get it out of your head. I don't know how. You got to go stand on your head. You got to go sit alone on a mountain. You got to take drugs. You got to, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got to get it out of your head.
Yeah.
It was taught to you. It was inculcated into you. It was told you that that's the template whereby you run yourself.
Yeah.
But it's not true and it's not good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Am I right or am I being extremist?
Oh, no. I think you're totally right. All right. I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, it's late.
Yes.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.